originally from Ohio, got his BS degree from Ohio State University, and master's and PhDs from Texas A&M. And following graduation 1987, he took a position as a research soil scientist at the USDA ARS Soil and Water Management Unit in St. Paul, Minnesota. He became the research leader of the unit in 2001. He's an adjunct professor in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate at the University of Minnesota, has been a division chair and a board representative in ASA, and is a fellow of ASA and Soil Science Society of America. With interests in both soil physics and biometeorology, his research has touched on a variety of transport processes both above and below the soil surface. So join in welcoming Dr. Baker.
I'm going to turn the lights down.
Okay. Well, judging from the size of the audience, this must be a way out of the box session that we're having here today. But that's okay. It's more intimate. We got more chance to talk. What I want to talk about today is the nitrate problem. Nitrate in ground and surface waters is an issue to varying degrees nearly everywhere that we practice agriculture. And it's a particular issue in the Corn Belt, but the real question here is, can we economically recycle nitrate? And we'll try and focus on that question today. As I mentioned, this is a particular issue in the Corn Belt. Corn's a remarkable crop. It's highly productive. Geneticists have improved it to the point where we are today, where we're getting bush yields in excess of 200 bushels per acre. And we have a processing system in place that can handle it. We have farmers that know how to grow it and have the equipment to plant it and harvest it. But there are some issues associated with it, environmental issues, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Corn needs a lot of nitrogen. High-yielding varieties that we plant today need typically in excess of 150 kilogram per hectare of nitrogen to achieve their yield potential. And that nitrogen has to come from soil water via transpiration. Still don't know how to fix, despite the dreams of geneticists, we still don't have end fixing corn, so it all has to come in the transpiration stream. And these are data that were published nearly 40 years ago by Darrell Watts and John Hanks, showing nitrogen uptake as a function of time in the growing season. And don't focus on the lines, which are just model estimates, but focus on the actual data points. And what you see is that corn takes up nearly all of its nitrogen in about a seven-week period, commencing roughly 40 days after planting. And so roughly in our part of the world, that means from 1st of June to late July. Now, transpiration during that period that we know from eddy covariance data is about 200 millimeters. And since nearly all that nitrogen is taken up as nitrate, that means that the root zone water content during this period has to be something in the neighborhood of 75 to 100 parts per million. And soil nitrate is mobile. Unfortunately, if you look at precipitation data, this is for Minnesota, but I think Iowa and Illinois are similar in the sense that these are historical probabilities of heavy rainfall on a daily basis throughout the year. And what you see is that the highest probabilities of heavy rain occur right when that nitrogen needs to be out there for the corn crop. And in fact, we typically have to apply it before the season starts. So you've got this period when there's a high likelihood of heavy rainfall when we've got all that nitrogen out there for the corn to take up. And so it's, in essence, it's an inherently leaky system. And if you talk to people who have spent their whole careers trying to address this problem of nitrate losses in corn systems, I think a number of them have come to the conclusion after working on tweaks with form of nitrogen, timing of nitrogen, different forms of tillage and whatnot, that they all have relatively minor impacts. And so in recent years, the focus has kind of implicitly shifted towards an emphasis of, well, how do we deal with this nitrate after it gets into drainage water, after it gets below the root zone? And to this point, The primary emphasis has been on encouraging microbes to denitrify it through bioreactors, constructed wetlands, controlled drainage, saturated buffers. The general idea, of course, is to provide a carbon source and starve the microbes for oxygen so that they'll then use nitrate as an electron acceptor, and nitrogen goes off primarily as N2 gas. This is a big project. I mean, when you put in a bioreactor, number one, you've got to essentially have to have tile drainage in place. You've got to go to the drainage outflow, dig up a substantial volume of soil, fill it up with wood chips or another carbon source, and then bury it. It's not a trivial exercise. And there are some issues associated with it. Costly to install. And while most of it does go off as dinitrogen, there is the possibility that you're going to lose nitrous oxide during the process. Big question farmers often ask is, what do you do when the carbon is gone, when the wood chips are gone? Do you dig it up and put more in? But more to the point today, it's always seemed to me that this is inherently wasteful. It takes a lot of energy to make nitrogen fertilizer from dinitrogen gas. It's a covalent triple bond. It's very difficult to break. We didn't even know how to do it until the 1920s when Bosch and Haber developed the process for converting it. And that's an energy-intensive process. It requires heat and pressure and catalysts. Releases a lot of greenhouse gas in the process. You know, we go to all this trouble to make it. I think it behooves us to think a little bit about whether there's some way that we can keep some of it in reactive plant available form. And that is what we've been looking at recently. That's one of the motivations, of course, for using winter cover crops, and they can be very effective under certain circumstances. However, they're not a panacea for nitrate loss. Particularly as far north as we are, there's a narrow window for establishment. You often get very little fall growth and nitrate uptake. And in addition, it's difficult to control the timing of end release from the cover crop to the next crop. And also, cover crop's typically not present out there when that post-planting nitrate loss can occur in summer thunderstorms. So I started looking a number of years ago about whether there was another option here. And let's talk about ED. Electrodialysis, that is. It's a process for transferring ionic species from one stream of water to another. Makes use of selective membranes, anion permeable and cation permeable membranes. When you stack a number of these together in alternating between anion and cation permeable, and you plumb it up so that the odd-numbered channels are all plumbed together and the even-numbered channels are all plumbed together, and then impose a potential gradient across it, a voltage potential, the anions will move towards the anode, cations will move towards the cathode. They each can only move across one membrane before they encounter a membrane that's impermeable to them. And so you end up with alternating streams of enriched and dilute water. Now, this is not a new process. This is a mature technology. It's been widely used for desalination around the world. And it's also used in a number of industrial processes for recovering reagents. There have been some pilot scale demonstrations of nitrate removal from primarily from groundwater wells in Morocco, Turkey, and a few other locations around the world. But it hasn't seen much use for this in the United States. And to my knowledge, has not been used to simultaneously both remove nitrate from one source of water and concentrate it in another for reuse as fertilizer. And that's what we decided to explore the possibility of. So initially, we proceeded with a small test in a greenhouse. Serendipitously, we had available to us six soil monoliths called mesocosms that in an unrelated experiment had been used to grow corn. These were filled with soil from a farm in southern Minnesota, horizon by horizon, and corn was grown to maturity with U of M recommendations for nitrogen application. And a few months after they'd harvested the corn, we went in and applied a little less than 6 centimeters of rainfall to it, kind of simulating spring rains, and collected the leachate in these two large tanks. And initially, they both contained water of the same concentration and equal amounts of it. And it was about 60 ppm. I mean, it's a little higher than what you normally see coming out of a farm field, but not too far off of what we've seen in fields surrounding some of the dairies that we work with. We plumbed it up to a tiny electrodialyzer. Does this work, Gary? Well, this works too.
Okay.
There in the middle, there's actually 10 pairs of membranes in there, as I mentioned, alternating cation and anion permeable, and hooked it up to a little DC power supply. We set this up in batch mode, so the blue tank was run continuously through the what I would call the concentrate or brine side, and then circulated back to the tank. And this was the diluate side, so we circulated that through the diluate side and then back to the tank, and ran it in batch mode, just with a small voltage of a little under 8 volts, and just watched the concentration just to kind of convince ourselves that it does indeed work. And on the brine side, the concentrations increase, and this doesn't show the whole course, but it went over 150 ppm, and on the dilute side, under 10 ppm in space of a 24-hour period. So that was enough to at least convince me to look at it a little bit further with a limited scale field test. And this is kind of a hypothetical installation of how we would maybe use this in the field. Now here we would do it in flow through rather than batch mode, although on the concentrate side we would still treat this as a batch mode process. So we have a tank where we would initially fill it with water from the stream or ditch, and then it goes through the concentrate side of the dialyzer and back. While on the other side is a flow-through system, so we pull water in from the stream or ditch, run it through the dilute side, and then back to the ditch. And as I mentioned, this is a DC system, so it's amenable to operation with a bank of batteries that can be powered with solar panel or a wind turbine. We looked for a suitable site to test it and settled on a stream that's about an hour south of the Twin Cities. It's a stream called Trout Brook. As the name implies, it's a trout stream, so it's of considerable interest to the DNR and others. It's also it's probably the most degraded stream with respect to nitrate in southeast Minnesota, and consistently runs in the neighborhood of 20 ppm. We worked on the West Branch, which has a watershed of about 3,000 hectares, and it's essentially all agricultural and all in corn and soybeans, with the exception of one feedlot. It's also karst topography, so there's fractured drainage, that feeds springs that in turn give rise to Trout Brook. It flows into the Cannon River right down here, which then flows into the Mississippi not far away. This is what it looks like up in the upper reaches. So there are springs that feed it, and then by the time it reaches the first road, it's a stream of this size. And those are nitrate N concentrations over the course of a season, consistently between 20 and 25 ppm. So we set up a system on the bank. And consists of, this is the tank that we contain the concentrate in. It's a 100-gallon tank just on a trailer. We learned quickly that we had to keep it covered with reflective material to keep all light out of it to avoid any algal growth in there. Also added a little bit of copper sulfate to avoid algae. And then everything else is contained in this little Rubbermaid container, similar to what you might put garbage cans in. And this is a larger dialyzer. This has bigger membranes and more of them, 25 pairs in this one. And then a variety of pumps, plumbing, data logger to control it, and other odds and ends. It's all powered by bank solar panels and feeding a bank of batteries that run the system. And because we were waiting on equipment, we didn't get a chance to run this for as long a period as we would have liked to, but we did collect some data, about a month's worth of data during September. Basically, we pull water in on the to start the process, and the water coming in was in the range of 21 to 24 ppm. Goes into the dialyzer and then back down to the stream where it empties out, and it's the range of 8 to 9 ppm. Takes about the flow rates that we ran this at were in the neighborhood of 4 gallons per minute, so not a real high flow, and it required about 50 watts of power for the dialysis process. With both the system in the greenhouse and the system in the field, we looked at some of the parameters associated with it. This is looking at nitrate removal efficiency in terms of kilograms of N removed per kilowatt hour of electricity put in as a function of the concentration of the diluate. And what you see is it's relatively insensitive to it until you drop down below 10 ppm, and then as it gets more and more dilute, the process is less efficient. It doesn't just concentrate nitrate, it concentrates all small cations and anions that are present. Now these are all normalized by their initial concentrations, and you can see that it is more efficient and more effective in concentrating nitrate than some of the others, but it's also concentrating chloride and calcium, sulfate, magnesium, and whatnot. Now if you look at the actual concentrations, several of those are present in very small amounts, and so they're not a concern, but these are the four ions that we're primarily concerned with. Nitrate, which we want to get, of course. Chloride, which would be an issue if it got to a high enough concentration that it would affect plant growth. We don't think that's going to be an issue. And then calcium and magnesium are the bigger issues because you concentrate them too far and you start getting precipitation issues in the dialyzer. We believe we can control that by adding acid to the tank and keeping the pH below the pKa of bicarbonate, but that still remains to be demonstrated. These are some of the challenges associated with the maintenance issue, as I mentioned, dealing with precipitation, having to replace membranes from time to time, the scalability of this, whether we can build these and operate them economically at a large enough scale to solve some of the nitrogen problems that we have in the state. And then, of course, economics is the big one. Can we do this in a cost-effective way? And here's some relevant data to this whole question. This looks at the energy required for nitrogen fertilizer production currently. And it's roughly in the neighborhood of 10 to 12 kilowatt hours per kilogram required. For extracting nitrogen fertilizer with electrodialysis, somewhat lower than that, neighborhood of 7 to 9. But of course, the advantage here is that we don't use natural gas or coal. We do now, but we have the possibility of doing this with either wind power or solar power. And this is particularly intriguing because in the areas, a lot of the rural areas where we have issues with high nitrate, we also have wind farms and increasingly solar farms as well. So I think it's an intriguing possibility that this might be, that there might be a good natural linkage between the two. If you look at the current costs of dealing with excess nitrate downstream, municipal removal of nitrate from ag-contaminated wells in small cities within Minnesota that have had problems with excess agricultural nitrate in their drinking water, costs vary wildly, but they're typically, the ones I have seen, in the neighborhood of $17 to even up to $100 per kilogram of nitrogen removed. And of course, I think we're all familiar with the Des Moines Water Works issues and the costs associated with nitrate removal there, and it's led, of course, to a lawsuit against upstream watersheds. These are data that I took from a paper by Laura Christensen and Matt Helmers and an ag economist, I can't remember his name offhand, but a very interesting paper where they attempted to construct equal annual costs for nitrate mitigation strategies, and it was the economic scheme that they used allowed them to come up with a fair comparison of the cost of denitrification systems like these with cropping strategies that are also designed to solve the problem of excess nitrate. And this was initially very surprising to me, but when you think about it, it's not so surprising because these things all have high initial costs, but if you amortize them out over the lifetime of the project, and I think she typically considered 40 years there, those costs become rather small. Whereas with cropping systems, you've got to plant those cover crops every year. There are costs associated with that. There's equipment. There's the issues of possible yield loss, those sorts of things. So I kind of use this as an approach to take with respect to electrodialysis. And estimating the cost here depends on a variety of variables. One, of course, is the nitrate concentration of the source water. The more concentrated it is to start with, the more cost-effective it is. And so it's not going to be very cost-effective on waters that are only, you know, 7 or 8 ppm to start with, but waters that are 20 ppm, that's a different story. It's also a function of water flow rate versus system capacity because the initial costs are high. Whatever size system you buy, you want to be able to run it at full capacity, the full flow rate capacity of it. Similarly, you want to be able to run it for as much of the non-frozen year as you can. When you have high initial costs, you don't want to run the system for just a month. You prefer to run it for 7 months if you can. Similarly, the lifetime of the unit itself, there is an extensive history on this in commercial applications and desalination applications, and they do seem to last for 40 years or more with appropriate maintenance. Membranes need to be replaced from time to time, and we factored that in as well. And then, of course, power source, if you can do it with renewable energy, ultimately it's going to be less expensive. Given that, you get a wide range of estimates, but in the best case scenario, if you can run a system at full capacity and you've got nitrate in the source water that's, you know, 20 ppm or so, we can do this for about two. We think we can do this for about 220 per kilogram, something like that. But if the duty cycles are short, the nitrate concentrations are not that high, it's going to be quite a bit more expensive. And so it's kind of a broad range between the denitrifying practices here, but it fits somewhere in between the two. And so obviously there's only going to be certain situations where this is going to be practical. It's not going to be a cure-all across the whole Corn Belt, but for instance, cases where we're dealing with CAFOs that are generating drainage waters that are very high nitrogen concentration, or situations like Trout Brook where you've got a stream that consistently runs high, we think this has some real possibilities. And that brings me to my conclusions. I think we've convinced ourselves that nitrate can be extracted from one water source and concentrated in another one for subsequent fertilizer use with electrodialysis. And the energy requirement is comparable to and actually less than manufactured fertilizer. It's particularly amenable to renewable energy sources. But as I just kind of alluded, the economic picture is a bit complicated, and that's going to have to be factored in terms of deciding where we might apply this and where it's not appropriate. With that.
Thanks. We've got a few minutes here for questions.
I'm curious, the internal components of electrodialysis, is it all corrosion resistant?
Corrosion can be an issue, and you have to be a little bit.
Before I sulfate, and there's a certain ratio there that once it becomes a certain fraction of alkalinity, then all of a sudden corrosivity just skyrockets.
You do need to know what your source water is, and it is going to require some babysitting in that regard. That's certainly true.
And as far as the membrane, do you have decreased surface life from organic acids are known to foul a lot of membranes?
Yeah, the manufacturers that I've spoken with have suggested that that they think that we could factor in lifetimes of 12 to 15 years for them. We, in analysis that I did, I used 7 to 10 years because I wanted to be a little conservative on that. But again, that's one of the issues I should have mentioned and I intended to mention. One of the challenges we ran into in Trout Brook is that you've got to filter out sediment. And so we had to change filters fairly often. But that was partly because the pumps we were using were very sensitive to sediment as well. So there's a variety of issues like that that still need to be worked out. And that's why I would still consider it. And it certainly fits the out-of-the-box description, I think. But I also think it's promising.
Laura?
Did your economic analysis, I know you talked about scalability being a challenge, did you sort of find that ideal zone of it's more economical to do it at this scale than bigger or smaller?
You know, we did look at that, and we were hopeful that there would be economies of scale that would, because, you know, when I did the analysis for the small ones, obviously it turns out very expensive, and it does improve with size, but only to a point, and we didn't, I haven't run enough numbers to really find that sweet spot, I guess I would say. Good question.
Cool. Why didn't you use EVE instead of solid osmosis, for example, solid osmosis, and people are saying that is much, much lower than the EVE or other specific technologies?
I guess I didn't fully understand it. Were you asking about reverse osmosis?
What was the reason of you using EVE and not solid osmosis, for example?
Go ahead and repeat the question.
Yeah, if I understand it correctly, you're asking why we used ED rather than reverse osmosis. The initial analysis we did convinced us that the costs would be lower with ED because of the power requirements for generating the high pressures that you need in RO systems.
Yep. What did you do with the brine, if you will, afterwards? And I guess the other part of that question is that there is some part of Fort Minnesota and elsewhere in the country that such a, for instance, design stores to help alleviate salinity issues. And so if an EV system is put on, say, a tire line, those you would concentrate those salts and you might not be able to identify them.
Yeah, a couple questions embedded in there. What about the application of this in areas where we're concerned about salinity? And then, I can't remember the initial one. What did we do with the brine? Well, the first part is easy. We just spread it on the lawn surrounding our research building because we were only dealing with small amounts of it. Salinity issues are going to be a problem in more arid environments. The further west you go, the less likely, or the less, the more that's going to be a problem. But our nitrate issues in drainage waters are more a problem in more humid regions, and so I think that those kind of tend to balance each other out. Well, there's about 10 next steps, and so we haven't entirely decided which one, but one is certainly going to be looking at how we can concentrate it further, because one of the challenges with this is that if you have to move that concentrate very far, you want that to be as concentrated as possible, and so we need to figure out how far we can take this and how far we can concentrate things before we run into problems with respect to precipitation and whether we can handle those adequately. So I would say those are the first things that we're going to do.
Good. We're going to cut right here. Hold your questions, though, because there's more discussion time after all the speakers are done. Let's thank John again.